From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Department of State announces the termination of a broad range of assistance to the government of Honduras as a result of the coup d'etat that took place on June 28.
The Obama administration cuts over $30 million in aid to the Honduran coup regime as ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya meets with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington. We'll talk to Latin America historian Greg Grandin about the battle for Honduras and the region. Then, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal joins us for the first interview about his debut book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And we'll look at how the No Child Left Behind Act allowed military recruiters to collect information on millions of unsuspecting teens. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. Between 60 to 90 Afghans have been killed in a U.S. bombing in northern Afghanistan. The attack struck a pair of fuel lorries that had been captured by Taliban fighters. There are reports the toll included an estimated 40 civilians who had gathered to siphon fuel off the tankers. Most of the bodies were burned beyond recognition. A Taliban spokesperson said the tankers had been hijacked as they made their way to refuel U.S. forces in Kabul. The bombing comes as the Obama administration considers plans to order thousands of additional troops to Afghanistan. The New York Times reports the proposals are under consideration include a so-called low-risk option that would send 45,000 troops. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said he was open to a troop increase and defended the continued occupation.
I absolutely do not think it is time to get out of Afghanistan, and I think that the notion that you can conduct a purely counter-terrorist kind of campaign and do it from a distance simply does not accord with reality.
Secretary Gates's comments came hours after the Pentagon said it will extend the tours of some 3,000 soldiers in Afghanistan for up to 2 months. Meanwhile, in Britain, a top official has resigned in protest of the British government's handling of the Afghan occupation. The official, Eric Joyce, worked as a senior defense aide under Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Joyce says he's stepping down over what he calls a failing strategy in Afghanistan and the absence of a clear timetable for the withdrawal of foreign troops. The Obama administration has formally cut more than $30 million in aid to Honduras. Thursday's announcement came shortly after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya in Washington. Zelaya praised the move as a step toward forward in pressuring the coup regime.
Yo creo que ya con esta decisión de Estados Unidos faltará escuchar.
I think with this American decision, although we have not heard from Canada yet, a single bloc of all 34 countries of the Americas has formed, which condemns the coup and not recognizing its authorities, and also not recognizing the authority of a regime's fraudulent elections, which is the result of the lack of liberty and the repression against the Honduran people.
The State Department also acknowledged Zelaya's ouster was a coup, but refused to formally designate it as such. Under U.S. law, a coup designation would force the Obama administration to cut off up to $150 million in funding to Honduras. We'll have more on Honduras after headlines. In Ecuador, attorneys for Amazonian residents seeking damages from the oil giant Chevron are accusing the company of trying to illegally interfere with their case. The residents have sued Chevron for dumping billions of gallons of toxic oil waste into Ecuador's rainforest. An independent court-appointed expert has recommended Chevron pay up to $27 billion in compensation. But earlier this week, Chevron released secretly recorded video, which it says proves the judge in the case has been guilty of judicial corruption. Chevron contends the video shows Judge Juan Nunez discussing ruling in favor of the Amazon residents, as well as a $3 million bribe for contracts involving another company. On Thursday, Judge Nunez said the videos were manipulated.
The tapes have been edited, manipulated, and they aren't evidence of anything. What they are evidence of is the illegal acts carried out by Chevron. That's what it is evidence of.
No me he reunido como usted a lo mejor amplía la pregunta.
I haven't met with members of the government. I was never in these meetings. I was paid a visit by Olo Gielo and Hansen and Borja in the Socumbios court. They came to see me there and filmed inside my office, inside the court. I didn't go looking for them.
Yo no les he buscado.
Lawyers for the Amazon residents say they're considering an additional suit against Chevron for trying to disrupt the case. Julio Prieto of the Amazon Defense Coalition dismissed the video as a stall tactic.
This seems to me to be a last-minute strategy, a smokescreen to distract public attention and to gain time. Why are they going to gain time? Because with how bad this looks, the judge is surely going to be removed from the case, and the new judge will have to start everything from zero again, and it would take any human being a considerable amount of time to do that. Now that we're so close to hearing the sentence, I would say that this is a dirty strategy to win them one more year.
The Treasury Department has enacted President Obama's directive to ease certain restrictions on dealings with Cuba. The new rules allow for unlimited travel and money transfers by Cuban Americans to their family members in Cuba and free up telecommunications that are directed there. The Obama administration announced the ease restrictions in April but has refused calls to fully repeal the 47-year-old embargo. A coalition of indigenous and environmental groups has filed a lawsuit against a planned pipeline that would carry oil from the Canadian tar sands to the United States. The suit comes less than 2 weeks after the State Department authorized the Alberta Clipper, a 1,000-mile pipeline running from Alberta to Wisconsin. Tar sand oil extraction is said to generate up to 5 times the greenhouse gas pollution of conventional oil. The lawsuit says the Obama administration has violated federal law by failing to properly gauge the pipeline's environmental impact. The co-chairs of the House Progressive Caucus have sent President Obama a letter vowing to reject health care reform legislation that does not include a public option based on Medicare rates. In the letter, Democratic Congress members Lynn Woolsey of California and Raul Grijalva of Arizona write, quote, "A health reform bill without a robust public option will not achieve the health reform this country so desperately needs. We cannot vote for anything less." The letter follows reports the White House has privately revived a plan that would trigger a public option only if private insurers are deemed not to have provided suitable care and market competition. And the Ohio-based electronic machine company Diebold has sold off its voting machine business to a rival firm. Diebold's touchscreen voting machines have been criticized for being prone to manipulation in elections across the United States. Diebold's main competitor, Election Systems and Software, has purchased Diebold's subsidiary Premier Election Solutions for over $5 million. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. We begin the show with the latest news on the coup in Honduras. On Thursday, the Obama administration formally cut more than $30 million in aid to Honduras and suggested it will not recognize the Honduran elections scheduled for November unless the vote is free and open. The State Department also acknowledged President Manuel Zelaya's ouster on June 28th was a coup, but it refused to formally describe it as a military coup. Under the U.S. Foreign Operations Bill, such a declaration would force an immediate suspension of most aid until rule of law is restored. This is State Department spokesperson Philip Crowley.
The Department of State announces the termination of a broad range of assistance to the government of Honduras as a result of the coup d'etat that took place on June 28. The secretary already had suspended assistance shortly after the coup. The Secretary of State has made the decision consistent with U.S. legislation, recognizing the need for strong measures in light of the continued resistance of the adoption of the San Jose Accord by the de facto regime and continuing failure to restore a democratic constitutional rule to Honduras. At this point, what's vitally important is that in order for Honduras to have a restoration of a normal relationship with the United States, a normal relationship with the rest of the region, and a resumption of aid, they're going to have to produce a government that comes into office through a free, fair, and transparent and democratic process.
That was State Department spokesperson Philip Crowley speaking shortly after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with ousted Honduran leader Manuel Zelaya in Washington. Zelaya has repeatedly called on the Obama administration to do more to force the coup government to step down. Well, joining us in the Firehouse studio now is Greg Grandin, professor of Latin America history at New York University. He recently returned from Honduras and wrote about it for The Nation magazine in the article Battle for Honduras and the Region. His latest book is Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City. Welcome to Democracy Now, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the importance of the latest news from Washington and the declaration by the government yesterday.
Well, it's a step in the right direction, and it's another indication that the United States is playing catch-up with Latin America, with South America, the Organization of American States, the Union of South American Nations, which have long ago, months ago, said that they won't recognize any election and the outcome of any election held under the current regime. And it's also an indication we're entering the end game of the current coup. It's 2 months to the November 29th election, and it's clear that free and fair elections can't be held under the current situation. The country's being militarized, institutions of state are being militarized. There's a low-level, constant violence that protesters and everyday citizens living under. Violence against women have increased 60% in the last 2 months. We're seeing a purging of cultural institutions. So it's clear that free and fair elections can't be held, and it's the United States coming around to that and desperate to figure out a way to end this before we get to the November 29th elections.
But this distinction between calling it a coup but not a military overthrow, what's
at stake with this is that that it would, aside from what you mentioned, that it would automatically trigger certain cutoffs, financial cutoffs, it also would have to be certified by Congress. And that's a fight that I think Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton don't want, because the Republicans, led by Connie Mack and other foreign policy conservatives, regime change conservatives, Republicans, have seized on this issue to basically try to link Obama with Hugo Chavez and the Latin American left. And they certainly don't want to kick it into Congress where it'll be debated, because to call it a coup would have to be certified by Congress.
And this the question of the government raising now the possibility of not recognizing the November 29th elections, what impact could that possibly have, or is there any indication that there'll be any change before the election?
Well, just let me say that it's a step in the right direction, but it wasn't as strong a statement as the Organization of American States. There was a qualifying clause to the State Department. At this time, the State Department can't recognize the current elections held under the prevailing system. But it is a step in the right direction. The coup leaders in Honduras and the coup government are caught in a bit of a bind. On the one hand, the best they can hope for is apathy and disillusionment among the citizenship, which have made it very difficult for them to rule and consolidate power within Honduras. On the other hand, they have to show that the elections are legitimate, and they have to encourage participation. So Congress just passed a law saying that they're going to prosecute anybody who doesn't vote in the November 29th election, because the opposition to the coup is calling a boycott.
What about Zelaya himself? Obviously, weeks ago, he attempted twice to get back into the country, once by in a flight and then at the border. It does seem increasingly that he will not be returning to power. Is that your sense from being down there and reporting on it?
Or if he returns, it'll be a purely symbolic return, which would be something. If he does return, even symbolically, I think it would galvanize. The resistance movement, which basically formed as a result of the coup, the people who staged the coup basically managed to achieve everything they accused Zelaya of doing. They've polarized the country, they've delegitimized political institutions, and they've created a popular movement that is growing in strength every day. And Zelaya at this point is more of a symbolic figure. So even if he were to return just for a week or just for 2 weeks, I think it would be an indication of the strength of the popular movement, which is actually applying much more pressure than the United States is internally, than the United States is externally.
What do you make of the decision of the International Monetary Fund recently to give Honduras, $160 million
yeah.
in aid?
Well, one hand takes away, the other one gives. The United States largely controls the IMF, and the fact that the IMF pretty much concurrently with the State Department's much heralded decision to cut off $30 million, the IMF announced that it was granting $150 million. I mean, even the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Fund, all of these institutions have declared that they're cutting off loans and aid to Honduras, but the IMF went forward. This also is largely symbolic. Honduras is currently hemorrhaging about $20 million a day in currency in its reserves in its central bank. About $500 million has dissipated over the last 2 months since the coup started. Whoever comes into office in December, in January, is going to be presiding over what is in effect a bankrupted country. And that's another aspect. Not only will aid resume, I think that the political elite and economic elite in Honduras realize that they're going to have to reestablish good relations with the rest of the world in order to stay afloat.
And the impact of this continuing, at least until now, the continuing success of this coup for the region?
Well, I think that it has to be seen in the context of the rise of the South American left and one country after another. And I think conservatives and a lot of people who maybe understood themselves as centrists but are very scared by what they imagine as the rise of the populist left see Honduras as a line in the sand, the first pushback against the rising tide of populism. The coup leaders in Honduras explicitly justify it as such, as the first rollback of Chavismo, and I think it's being understood as a battle for which way Latin America turns. There's a whole new series of elections coming up in Uruguay and Chile and Brazil and Argentina that may give conservatives wins, and I think that may push back on the left a little bit in this next round of elections, and a lot of anti-Chavistas, for lack of a better word, see Honduras as a potential turning point.
And speaking of the battle for the region, the continuing controversy over President Uribe of Colombia agreeing to more involvement by U.S. military forces in bases in Colombia, it's been condemned widely by the other governments of the region. Your assessment of this in terms of the battle for the region?
Well, in South America, under the current political alignment, both Honduras and both the United States is waffling and dithering on Honduras, and the announcement that the United States military is going to expand, have access to 7 military bases running from the Caribbean to the Andes, has united South America. I mean, this is not just an issue about Venezuela, although Venezuela gets all the attention in the press, but Brazil and the Brazilian military is very concerned about this ability of the United States now to project its military power into the Amazon, deep into South America. And there's been a large unification among most South American states against this, and it's an indication of the further isolation of the United States in terms of political influence, its institutional influence, and increasing dependence on military influence in order to project its power into the region. It's a dangerous precedent.
Greg Grandin, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of Latin American history at New York University. His article, Battle for Honduras in the Region, appears in The Nation magazine. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Republican Gomorra, inside the movement that shattered the party. Stay with us.
Deslumbrar, buenos días, ya salió el sol, es un nuevo amanecer, llegó el momento de hacer, representando latinos al poder, hip hop latino al mando, arriba las manos, vamos, vamos, todos mis hermanos, si eres real, es hora de alzar tu voz, no somos ni uno ni dos, somos miles y millones, que la sombra tenemos que vivir, de la sombra queremos salir, hacernos sentir nuestros derechos, exigir conciencia directa y legal, con un flow al natural, un mensaje universal, en busca de la evolución mental, con revolución mental. Unificación social, unificación racial. Es un momento crucial que no nos dé igual. Los latinos en el mundo marcamos una huella especial.
Ningún pueblo de América Latina es débil, porque forma parte de una familia de 200 millones de hermanos y cuentan con la solidaridad de todos los hombres y mujeres honrados del mundo.
Al armas en las manos. Todos mis latinos que aquí llegó el jefa con filo de machete como campesino. No es comercial, no es falso, es rifa del vino. Latinoamérica, seguimos abriendo camino. Tantos años somos oprimidos, somos bloqueados. El verdadero jefa la gente no ha escuchado, porque la industria musical nos ha ignorado. Pero el sexto sol del jefa aquí ha llegado. Somos inteligente, gente consciente. Me identifico con el pobre, con el indigente, con un mensaje de lucha para todita mi gente. Jefa latino de calle, eso es lo que se siente. Es la vivencia del pobre lo que hemos vivido en Guatemala, Colombia, los Estados Unidos. Jefa revolucionario siempre está.
Latinos al poder by Ilegal. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Juan Gonzalez. 50 years ago, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower issued a warning against the rise of extremist movements within his own party. During his presidency, Eisenhower had endured attacks by Senator Joseph McCarthy, the radical right John Birch Society, and others. In a 1959 letter to a World War II veteran, Eisenhower wrote, quote, "Many prominent officials, possessing no standing or expertness as they themselves claim it, attempt to further their own ideas or interests by resorting to statements more distinguished by stridency than by accuracy." Half a century later, in a summer of town hall disruptions and birth certificate controversies, what Eisenhower had warned against has come true, that the Republican Party has been captured by its extremist wing. At least that's what award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal argues in his new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. The book examines the transformation of the GOP from the party of Dwight Eisenhower to the party of Sarah Palin, and how this sets the stage for the future of American politics. Max Blumenthal is a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute. He joins us today for his first extended interview about his book, Republican Gomorrah. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you had an op-ed piece in the Times this week citing that Eisenhower quote. Can you talk about that warning of Eisenhower and its your sense of how true it rings today?
I actually discovered that Eisenhower letter while doing some research for my book, Republican Gomorrah. You know, for the past 6 years, I've covered the radical right. I've gone to their conventions. I've interviewed their leaders. I've gone to their houses of worship. And I've gotten a sense of what conservatism has become. How radical it's become, and the extent to which the Christian right has taken over the Republican Party. So when I found this letter by Eisenhower to a military veteran who was dying at the time, and he didn't really have to respond to his letter, I was really riveted by it, by this prophecy, and I found it even a little bit eerie. I think that his warning about the rise of extremist movements should be as memorable in history as his warning about the military-industrial complex, because he saw what was happening to his Republican Party. Eisenhower really believed in the big tent philosophy of the Republican Party, that in order to be a national party, you had to have a broad constituency. Today, the Republican Party is a one-ring circus, and it's controlled by people like Sarah Palin, who are warning of death panels, that Barack Obama's health care plan will decide who lives and who dies. It's controlled by people like Representative Paul Brown, this born-again Christian who was recently elected, who's comparing Barack Obama simultaneously to Hitler and Stalin. It's controlled by, it actually has no leadership. It's controlled by the movement that I say shattered the party, which is substantially the Christian right. And the conservatism that defines it is not an ideology or a set of ideas. It's really a sensibility. It's a social psychology that I think is best summarized by a quote by Newt Gingrich, who supported Sarah Palin's claim about death panels. Newt Gingrich said, "I think you can write a psychological profile of me that says I found a way to immerse my insecurities in a cause large enough to justify whatever I wanted it to." And so in Eisenhower's letter, he actually recommended a really fascinating book by Eric Hoffer, who is a self-educated dock worker, to this military veteran. And the central thesis of Hoffer's book, The True Believer, is that faith in a holy cause is really a substitute for lost faith in ourselves. And that's sort of the thesis of my book and how and what I've discovered from the true believer of the Republican Party that I've been around for the past 6 years.
Well, what I found riveting in your book was the most people associate the rise of the modern radical right in the Republican Party with Barry Goldwater and the elections of 1964. But you actually trace it much further back to a bunch of people that few Americans have ever heard of, Francis Schaeffer or R.J. Rushdoony, R.H. Amundsen. Could you talk about these individuals and their enormous impact on the current crop of radical right leaders?
Yeah, I don't want to go too far back in the past. I want to try to keep it present. But I talk about R.J. Rushdoony because this theologian, who's almost unheard of, influenced the Christian right and provided them with their blueprint for what they saw as the Promised Land, which was actually a theocratic dystopia. He advocated substituting theocracy for the Constitution, wrote 1,000-word tomes explaining how this would work out during the 1960s, during the battles for desegregation, and influenced people like Jerry Falwell. And under Rushdoony's plan, disobedient children, witches, blasphemers, adulterers, abortion doctors would all be executed according to Leviticus case law. As extreme as it sounds, it had an enormous impact on the right-wing evangelical movement as it moved from the pews into the political realm, because it gave them something to campaign for, even if what they were going to get was going to be more along the lines of a Republican Gomorrah than what they saw as a theocratic, theocratic Canaan. Francis Schaeffer is the guy who really gave them the tactics to make this happen. During the 70s, people like Jerry Falwell were still preoccupied with segregation. They were still upset that their Christian schools had to accept African American children. And Francis Schaeffer told them, "No, we have to campaign on abortion. Abortion
but
is the issue."
Schaeffer? What was
and
it?
Schaeffer is a really fascinating and tragic character. He was an iconoclastic theologian who set up a Christian hippie commune in the Swiss Alps. And I write about, how this commune, in my book Republican Gomorrah, I write about how this commune accepted lesbians and African Americans and all kinds of people, as long as they, believed in Christ. Timothy Leary visited this commune. Jimmy Page, the guitarist for Led Zeppelin, carried in his back pocket one of Francis Schaeffer's books. So he was sort of a tolerant character. But when Roe v. Wade happened, something snapped inside Francis Schaeffer, and he became concerned that the United States government would eventually legalize infanticide, and inspired this evangelical movement to take up the cause of abortion when they were preoccupied with segregation, and eventually helped create the Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell. He helped convince Jack Kemp and Gerald Ford that abortion was an important issue. And from the Swiss Alps to Washington, he became an evangelist in the truest sense of the word. The tragic part is that Francis Schaeffer despised so many of the evangelical, Southern Baptists who'd converged around him. He thought Pat Robertson was a pathological lunatic after Pat Robertson told him at dinner, as I write in my book, that he burned a Modigliani painting in his fireplace. He thought Jerry Falwell was a charlatan. He thought James Dobson, who was studying him very closely, was power mad. But at the same time, Francis Schaeffer was creating tactics and urging evangelicals to get out in the streets and fight even a violent war to stop abortion. And he wound up inspiring the group Operation Rescue that's responsible for the assassination of several abortion doctors, including Dr. Tiller recently in Kansas. And what's sad is Francis Schaeffer died prematurely, and what the movement went on beyond him. And his son is out there, and his son, Frank Schaeffer, has been on your show. And his son says, my father would have been so upset to see what the Christian right and the Republican Party's become today. He despised the homophobia of the movement. And what Frank Schaeffer told me, which is most interesting, is that this movement, we were like oncologists. We needed a crisis to keep occurring in American society in order for us to stay in business. And that's what we're seeing with the healthcare debate, too. I mean, we're seeing a movement that's terrified that the government will start to be able to solve people's crises because they survive and thrive on manipulating people's personal crises.
We're talking with Max Blumenthal. The book is Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And I'd like to continue with some of these lesser known figures that have been so influential. R.H. Amundsen. He, as you point out in the book, is the angel of much of the conservative causes, a financial angel. Could talk about his influence.
Well, I was the first journalist in 15 years to get an interview with Howard F. Amundsen, Jr. And, you know, your listeners and viewers in California might recognize the name Amundsen because of so many philanthropic entities that have been donated by his father, who is the great man of California. But Howard F. Amundsen, Jr. has Tourette's syndrome and largely speaks through his wife, shuns the media, and for some reason decided to speak to me in 2004. He was the man behind Proposition 8 in California, which banned same-sex marriage, Proposition 22 in California. Before that, the Intelligent Design Movement. He's donated $2.8 million to that. Countless right-wing Christian right causes across the country that have been successful have been funded by Howard F. Amundsen, Jr. And the reason that I was interested in him is because he embodies the sensibility of the movement that I'm writing about in my book, Republican Gomorrah, that controls the Republican Party. At age 18, Howard F. Amundsen, Jr. inherited $300 million from his father, who had just dropped dead. His mother died soon after. And he basically went crazy. He literally went crazy and wound up in a mental institution. When he came out of the mental institution, he found, as so many people do who have had a personal crisis and are seeking some kind of means of transcending it, evangelical religion. And he found R.J. Rushdoony, who I talked about earlier. He became Rush Dooney's financial angel, and Rush Dooney became his surrogate father. And he helped, and he declared Howard F. Amundsen, Jr. In 1985 that my goal for this country is the literal application of biblical law and its integration into our daily lives, which was the goal of Rush Dooney. And he's doing this through mainstream mechanisms, through the Christian right. He's able to still succeed even with the Democrats in power through ballot measures in California. And what it really is about creating this, what they see as this theocratic utopia, which is actually a becoming a Republican Gomorrah.
You have a whole chapter on James Dobson and calling him perhaps the most influential and respected member of the radical Christian right in America today. Talk about Dobson's influence, how he was shaped by some of these other figures you've talked about, and his relationship to Sarah Palin.
Right. Well, and Dobson was, a key acolyte of Francis Schaeffer. But Dobson's a central figure in my book. And, you know, a lot of commentators now, Frank Rich, for example, say that Dobson's influence is on the wane. But I credit Dobson, who has the third largest radio show in America, whose organization, Focus on the Family, has $150 million in its coffers and 36 policy councils in the states, and is widely credited for electing George W. Bush in the Republican Congress in 2004, with cultivating the sensibility of the movement that I'm writing about in my book, Republican Gomorrah, that controls the Republican Party. Dobson is a fascinating figure because although he's leading what is widely considered a religious movement, he's not a religious leader. He has no theological credentials. He's not a preacher. What is he? He's a child psychologist. And the way that he's won so many followers is by, you know, doing radio shows about common mundane problems like bedwetting, for example, or dealing with a child that has, issues with their sexuality, something like that. And he has a correspondence department in Focus on the Family that's so large it occupies an entire zip code in Colorado Springs. People write in with their personal problems. He sends them, his workers send them Dobson-approved advice. After they get into the database that Dobson maintains, he bombards them with political mailings and slowly cultivates them into Republican shock troops. So Dobson has, you know, turned personal crisis into political resentment. Where did Dobson's fortune come from? How did he erect this empire? It came mainly from one book, which I quote from extensively in my book, Republican Gomorrah, Dare to Discipline, which is essentially a manual for corporal punishment for beating your child. In this book, he says, pain is a marvelous purifier, that a child should be, that pain goes a long way with a child, that pain should be dispensed sufficiently enough to make a child cry, but then the child will crumple to your breast and you should welcome the child with warm, open arms. This is this is a recipe for sadomasochism. And sadomasochism, as I discovered...
And he saw himself originally as the antithesis to Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Dr. Benjamin Spock, who tells you to basically pick your child up and cradle it. And, you know, I mean, I was, you know, for whatever it's worth, I was raised along those guidelines. When your child's crying, you pick up the child. By creating a belt-wielding army of millions, Dobson created the next generation of Republican shock troops who are more radical than before. And sadomasochism, I know this sounds a little strange, is what defines the essential character, you know, that this is what I've discovered, of the Republican follower of today. They're sadistic in that they want to lash out at deviants, at people who are weaker than them, homosexuals, immigrants, foreigners, socialists. At the same time, they're masochistic. They are followers of a higher cause, of a strong leader, a magic helper like Dobson or George W. Bush or the macho Jesus archetype that they worship. And this is what defines this movement. So many of the people that Dobson has been able to get close to and work with in the Republican Congress and in American culture have been viciously abused as children. And he understood that by advocating violence against children, deliberate violence, he was creating this sensibility, which would produce a radical generation of political followers. Tom DeLay, for example, who Dobson converted from Hot Tub Tommy, a dallying, philandering, no-name legislator in Texas, you know, who lived in a house that was nicknamed Macho Manor. Dobson converted him into this hardcore, you know, into the hammer, the man who whipped the Republican Congress into shape and turned it into one of the most radical Congresses in history. Ted Bundy, who I write about extensively in my book, Republican Gomorrah, who is the most notorious serial killer in American history. Dobson helped convert Ted Bundy on death row into a born-again Christian, and then got the final interview before Ted Bundy was executed, and sold tapes of this interview to raise $1 million for his political empire and to generate national renown.
And Dobson has also become sort of like the counselor of choice for politicians who fall by the wayside in certain ways, hasn't he?
Well, and Newt Gingrich, for example, another person who was viciously abused as a child. Dobson led the coup against Gingrich that helped remove him as Speaker of the House, when a lot of Republicans were concerned that his leadership was weakening when they were trying to impeach Clinton, because Gingrich was carrying on an affair with a woman 20 years younger than him who was on the congressional payroll at the same time. She's his wife now. When Gingrich decided to resurrect his political career, he decided the Republican Party is controlled by the Christian right. He's not a stupid man. What do? I have to confess all of my sins by going on James Dobson's radio show, catering to the culture of personal crisis that lurks behind the right's politics of resentment. And so that's exactly what he did. He basically prostrated himself before Dobson, who has, you know, supposedly has no political standing. And the next thing you know, he's back on the national stage. He's welcomed at the Christian right gatherings. You can see him on Fox News now. So that shows, you know, how powerful Dobson is. But it's not just Dobson. It's a mentality that defines conservatism.
And the connection between Dobson and Sarah Palin?
Well, Dobson, you know, and a lot of his allies, many of his allies, had known about Sarah Palin before any of us did. And it didn't surprise me when Sarah Palin was selected, even though many people compared her to Dan Quayle and said she was a huge liability, that she was selected, because I knew from listening to Dobson's radio show every day Dobson talked about his correspondence with her and how he had been writing her letters, congratulating her on not aborting her child who had Down syndrome. And so when John McCain won the nomination, he knew that he needed to bring the Christian right around. I mean, there was no other way that he was going to win the Republican base, considering how loathed he was for denouncing Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson as agents of intolerance. So his advisors realized that Dobson was very favorable to Sarah Palin because whatever her qualifications were, however experienced she was, however articulate or inarticulate she was, she embodied the culture of personal crisis that I talk about in my book, Republican Gomorrah, that so many people in the Christian right identify with. Now, I also describe her as the archetype of the right-wing woman. You know, in 2005, I was able to meet someone named Leslie Unruh, who helped craft the Bush administration's abstinence agenda. She was given millions in federal funding to create textbooks for public schools that warned children that you could spread AIDS through sweat and tears. Henry Waxman reviewed these textbooks and found that 80% of the information was inaccurate. But I started to understand through my research what the right wing, the right wing archetypal woman was like. This is someone who had had an abortion, who had had a personal crisis, and became one of the leading anti-abortion activists in South Dakota. And so I started to understand this mentality. This is someone who wound up promoting Sarah Palin to the right-wing base because she saw in Sarah Palin someone who also advocated abstinence, but at the same time, her family was not practicing it. And that's something that that's happening in evangelical communities across the country. In Lubbock, Texas, for example, where abstinence has been mandated. I mentioned in my book that the rate of gonorrhea there is twice the national rate. So the process of crisis and confession and what a lot of people refer to as hypocrisy was essential to the rise of Sarah Palin because people could identify with her who are going through these struggles themselves.
Let me ask you, obviously the subtitle of the book is Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. How did it shatter the party, and how do you see bring it up to date right now, the healthcare debate, all these town hall meetings where we've seen this enormous antagonism toward the Obama administration and Senator David Vitter, for instance, in Louisiana, talking about resuscitating states' rights. How did this movement shatter the party, and how is it involved in this this enormous discontent that we're seeing at so many of these town hall meetings?
Well, I mean, I just mentioned Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin's selection as vice president, while it was necessary for the Republican Party, was also a complete disaster. She wasn't qualified. Most Americans saw that. But the Republican base had been winnowed out and was so heavily evangelical, so Southern, that they had no other choice but to pick this this person who the patrician former Republican senator from Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee, described as a cocky wacko. Peggy Noonan, I think the Reagan speechwriter, called her, I think, a lunatic. But that's what the Republican Party had become, the party of Palin. So what happened was John McCain won 3% more of the conservative vote than George W. Bush, who was a hardcore conservative, and lost 20% of the moderate votes that George W. Bush had, even though McCain was seen as a moderate. That's because of selecting Palin, because he had to cater to what the Republican Party had become. Out of power, the Republican Party relies on its grassroots. It has no leadership. It also has, and we're seeing that at town halls. We're seeing the Republican Party with no brakes, completely out of control, relying on the movement that controls it. And it's a very ugly spectacle. The problem is it has no capacity for bipartisanship. Everyone knows, it's clear from reading my book, Republican Gomorrah, that, and the picture that I provide of the Republican Party through my, research on it and my reporting on it, that they're not going to compromise on health care. And so the idea that, producing a bipartisan health care bill is going to be a better bill is a delusion. They won't produce a bill at all. And Barack Obama's tendency towards bipartisanship, I think, disregards the lessons of my book and will essentially damage the Democrats and especially the progressive agenda, because the people who I describe in my book, the movement I describe, knows that any government solution to the common personal crises that are happening every day in America, and a lot of them are related to healthcare problems, will mean the death of the empire of James Dobson and his allies.
And finally, the title, Republican Gomorrah, what did you mean by that?
Well, I talk in my book, extensively about all of the bizarre scandals that have, that have happened with Ted Haggard, with Mark Foley, with Larry Craig, which a lot of people attribute to hypocrisy. And which have produced a sort of a Gomorrah-like image of a party that had once been seen as a family values party. And these scandals have damaged the party, you know, incredibly. But I wanted to get beyond the hypocrisy and try to understand the mentality and the sensibility of the movement and what defines conservatism today, because that's what defines the Republican Party out of power. And it's a party that I consider to be still extremely dangerous to the agenda of Barack Obama and the progressive agenda as well. Even though they have no control over government, they can still affect the environment massively.
Well, Max Blumenthal, thank you very much for being with us. Max is a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. His new book just out, Republican Gomorrah. He will be launching it on Tuesday, September 8th in Washington, D.C. Go to www.republicangomorrah.com for more details. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. And it's a war that until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. As millions of students prepare for the start of another school year, we turn to an issue that concerns many parents: the increasing presence of military recruiters in the nation's high schools and the military's ability to gather information about students. Journalist David Goodman writes in the new issue of Mother Jones, quote, using data mining, stealth websites, career tests, and sophisticated marketing software, the Pentagon is harvesting and analyzing information on everything from high school students' GPAs and SAT scores to which video games they play. Before an Army recruiter even picks up the phone to call a prospect, the soldier may know more about the kid's habits than do his own parents. To talk more about this, David Goodman joins us on the phone. He's a contributing writer at Mother Jones Magazine. His latest article is titled A Few Good Kids. He's also the co-author with his sister Amy of three books. We're also joined by Ari Rosemarin, senior advocacy coordinator at the New York Civil Liberties Union. He works on the organization's Project Military Recruitment and Students' Rights. Welcome to the both of you. I want to start with David. It's not just No Child Left Behind. You talk in your article about all kinds of other ways that the government has been and the military has been getting information on America's youth.
That's right, Juan. You know, as families and students around the country are about to return to school this week and New York starts next week, what they may be unaware of is that in the pack, you know, my daughter, who's in high school, along with every high school student, comes this sheaf of papers that you get in a week or two before. Buried in that sheaf is a letter informing them that all information about every high school junior and senior in the country is being sent to military recruiters by default, unless you happen to notice this letter and choose to opt out. Oddly enough, this letter comes as a result of President George Bush's signature education law, the No Child Left Behind Act, which in 2002 included a provision slipped in by then-Representative, now-Senator David Vitter from Louisiana, requiring all high schools to provide directory and contact information to recruiters. It effectively transformed this supposed education law into the most aggressive military recruitment tool that the armed services have had to date. But that, as you point out, is not the only way that information is being gathered. At the same time as the No Child Left Behind law began harvesting this kind of directory information, which the military has not had before, you know, the sight of recruiters at malls and hanging around at high school football games and such has been the more typical scene that we are accustomed to with the all-volunteer Army. They go out and they try and meet young people wherever they think they'll hang out. Having emails, cell phone numbers, and home phone numbers is a whole new level for, you know, how recruiters can access young people. But there's more. We found out in 2005, privacy advocates were amazed to discover that the Pentagon had been amassing an extraordinary number of names. At this point, 34 million names of young people, which is said to be the largest repository of 16 to 25-year-old youth data in the country. Those are the military's own words, in something called the Jammers Database. That's the Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies Program of the Defense Department. This is where all information has now been centralized, from Selective Service to the No Child Left Behind directory info, but also it's from commercial data brokers. These include groups such as the Student Marketing Group and American Student List. Pentagon is currently spending about $600,000 a year on these data brokers. Now, what's of concern here, these data brokers are getting information from when you buy a yearbook, when you buy a student ring, when you take any number of, you know, just commercial purchases. However, both of these large commercial data brokers have been accused of using deceptive practices to gather the information. So the New York Attorney
General... David, you mentioned one website, marchtosuccess.com, which you say the Army spent $1.2 million backing this, and it supposedly provides tips to young people on standardized test taking. And only at the very bottom is it mentioned that it's sponsored by the U.S. military?
That's right. MarchToSuccess.com is being used by teachers all around the country. They send students to this website ostensibly to provide them with a free standardized test-taking tips. And this is designed by the top test prep firms, Kaplan, Princeton Review. Petersons is the current contractor providing the information. And yet, this is, in fact, a website run by the Army. You wouldn't know that unless you notice the little tagline in the lower right corner that links to GoArmy.com, which is the Army recruiting website, and by the Army's own words to me, one of their most effective recruiting vehicles is GoArmy.com. So, you know, the director of the program told me that of the MarchToSuccess.com said that we're providing a great service to schools that normally would cost them, but what he doesn't say is that this MarchToSuccess.com is currently registering an average of 17,000 new users each month, and you can elect to have a recruiter monitor your test progress. This is not a teacher. This is an Army recruiter who can coach you along and then presumably help you when it comes time to make decisions that obviously a recruiter hopes will land you in the armed forces.
And Ari Rosemarin of the New York Civil Liberties Union, the implications of this for privacy rights and for civil rights?
They're very serious. One of the hard things about doing Know Your Rights education around this issue, both in New York but also around the country, is that advocates and communities have done a good job of educating people over the last now about 7 years about No Child Left Behind and what the privacy implications are there. But what folks often don't realize is that coming out of that, there's also this massive program that's funded, obviously, as David talked about, billions of dollars that go into a whole range of recruitment efforts of towards getting information about young people through myriad different ways that mostly they have no idea is taking place. So there's a danger when, for example, a student will turn in an opt-out form, which maybe we'll get to, which keeps you out of your school from giving your information to a recruiter under No Child Left Behind. Meanwhile, the military has six other ways of getting that information. So there really has yet to be a meaningful, comprehensive way to keep your information away from military recruiters, which is unprecedented.
And how can parents opt out if they want to?
Of the Jammers database, it's actually, unfortunately, there is a way, but they want to make it very difficult for you. According to the Pentagon, the only way to what they call opt out of the database is for your parent. A student cannot do this his or herself. A parent needs to send a letter to the Pentagon asking the Pentagon to take their student out of the list. And even then, you're not removed from the list. You're put into what's called a suppression file, which is a separate list within the Jammer system and database system that keeps you away out of that list. But you're never really removed from the list.
Now, there's a lawsuit against the Jammers database?
There was. In 2005, the New York Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against the Pentagon, charging them with violating a couple different laws, the Privacy Act and the Defense Act. Basically, the military was putting information into this database and keeping it in certain ways that were in violation of the law, including keeping information on students as young as 15 in the database when the law only allows 17 and over. Keeping it for longer than 3 years, or keeping it for 5 years, collecting social security numbers, a number of different things. And that lawsuit ultimately settled, and we were successfully able to keep the military from keeping it for only 3 years, stopping collecting social security numbers, clarifying opt-out information, clarifying the privacy regulations. But interestingly, the one thing that, one of the main things that we wanted that the military refused to give in on was the collection of racial and ethnic data. And that's something that is not called for under the statute, but the military felt it was so important that they keep racial and ethnic data in the database that they pushed hard and refused to give in on that point. And it's when you look at the at enlistment numbers, the two factors that are the clearest indicators of who's going to end up in the military are racial and ethnic data and college plans. And so the military is certainly thinking about that when they do their recruitment.
And David Goodman, could you tell us about the use of video games by the military in their recruitment efforts?
Two of the main video games being used by the military. One is a video game that the Army itself has created. It is called America's Army. Amazingly, one in four males between the age of 13 and 24 have played this game. The new version, America's Army 3, was just released in June. And users who play it are, the Army says, 29% more likely to be interested in serving in the military. So this one is actually created by the Army. Another one that the Army...
And it's available free online or what?
Free online, yes. Another one is Halo 3, which is a hit Xbox game. It has sold more copies than the Harry Potter series. The Army spent over $1 million to sponsor Halo 3. And it has links. This is a Microsoft game, but has links where players can link out to the GoArmy.com recruiting website. So these are some of the other ways that the military is going. But I did just want to follow up on this question of what can concerned parents do.
You have about 30 seconds. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and that is that around the country, the ASVAB test is being administered in many high schools, and this is used by the military for recruiting, for placement in the military, and many students and parents are trying to get that test out of the schools because it's mandatory in many of the schools where it's administered. So that's a very important piece of activism that has been going on.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. Ari Rosmarin is the Senior Advocacy Coordinator at the New York Civil Liberties Union, and David Goodman is a contributing writer at Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to his website his article on our website. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. Tune in on Monday for our hour-long Labor Day special. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!